This is Malcolm Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff. Today we're going to be talking about conditional commands. When I was originally writing this podcast, I had in mind commands like, if you must recline your airplane seat, do it gently. But now we're hearing a lot of conditional commands like these.
Politicians, scientists, and even celebrities all want us to practice social distancing. If you can work from home, the government says you should, and your employer should help you do this. If you absolutely can't work from home, then avoid busy travel times.
But what should we make of obligations like these? It's pretty straightforward when someone tells you do X or don't do X. Things get trickier when we use the word if, making our commands conditional. I remember a few years ago having a discussion with someone about the children in my apartment complex. There are signs posted there in some common areas saying, do not ride scooters. But children kept riding scooters at rapid speeds, sometimes dangerously close to elderly people. I said to somebody, children really shouldn't be riding scooters, but if they do, they should ride slowly. And this other person was kind of outraged. They said, look, children shouldn't be riding scooters slowly or quickly. They shouldn't be riding them at all. I tried to explain that I agreed, but that if children rode, then they should ride them slowly. This other person saw what looked like a contradiction between two claims I was making. Children should ride scooters slowly, and children shouldn't ride scooters. After all, if you're riding a scooter slowly, it still means you're riding a scooter, and I had just said that children shouldn't do that. The same kind of problem comes up in other contexts, too. If you go outside and stay 6 feet away from other people, you're still going outside. And in a pandemic, aren't we obligated to stay inside? How do we understand these kinds of seeming conflicts? A philosophical tradition in India, known as Mimamsa, had to address just this question. This tradition, which was concerned with the interpretation of religious texts known as the Vedas, had their own conditional command, known as the Shena sacrifice.
The one who desires to kill their enemy should sacrifice with the Shena. My name is, in fact, Elisa Freschi. I work in Vienna at the Academy of Sciences and at the University of Vienna. And I work on multiple projects, but the main ones are on a theological school in South India called Vishishtadvaita Vedanta and a philosophical school called Mimamsa.
I talked with Elisa Freschi for this podcast, and she's an expert in Mimamsa and has written on this sacrifice and some of the puzzles about it.
So the Shena sacrifice is a malefic sacrifice. So it's a sacrifice through which you can kill an enemy.
I asked her to explain why it was a problem that Mimamsa philosophers had to address.
It apparently contradicts a Vedic prohibition to perform any violence on any living being. So basically we have three sorts of commands which are in a complex relation. One command is the prohibition to perform any violence on living being. In Sanskrit, it is nahinsyat sarva bhutani, so one should not perform violence on any living being. It's interesting that it doesn't say on any human being, it just says on any living being. And I'm highlighting it for because of something I'm going to say in a second. So that's the first problem. Then we have the Shena injunction, which tells you should, if you desire to kill your enemy, you should sacrifice bewitching with the Shena. So here the death of your enemy is mentioned, so this seems to clash with the prohibition to perform any violence. And then the third problem is that there are some sacrifices in which you have to kill a sacrificial animal. The typical example which is always mentioned is a sacrifice which is offered to the deities Agni and Soma, and which is therefore called Agnishomiya. So basically the three commands are in a complex relation. And the fascinating element is that all Mimamsakas agree that you have to perform the Agnishomiya and that you don't have to perform the Shena.
The case of the Shena sacrifice turns out to be a puzzle not just for Vedic ritual, but it also becomes an important example for legal studies or what's known as jurisprudence.
Mimamsa rules have been used all the time by jurisprudence authors, so the authors who wrote all the Dharma Shastras, all the treatises about jurisprudence throughout South Asian history.
Thinking about this example, Mimamsa might have some applications for other kinds of obligations then. Not just Vedic ritual, but for any situation where there are several obligations that could be in conflict, and some of them are put in this kind of conditional language. In the Indian context, for instance, this very case was used to help think about what's known as sati, a funeral practice in which widows would throw themselves on the burning corpse of their husband on their funeral pyre.
It's the discussion of the Shena sacrifice in connection with the ritual which is known in Europe and North America as sati. So the ritual killing of a widow which commits suicide on the sacrificial pyre of her husband, of her deceased husband. So the whole discussion about sati is focused on whether it is a case similar to Shena or not. So is it admissible or is it a case like the Shena, which means you should not perform it? So it was applied to real life situations and even to challenging issues like this one.
So let's return to the Shena sacrifice and see how different Mimamsa philosophers approach the problem. You might think there's an easy solution, which is thinking of one command as generally true, and the others as a sort of specific exceptions to the rule. In our context today, we might think that we have some specific commands that we want to follow. For instance, if you want to stay healthy, wash your hands. If you go outside, stay 6 feet away from people. We might add that everyone has a general obligation to stay indoors. So we might say then that we generally have an obligation to stay inside, but there are some specific commands that start with conditions using words like if, and these specific commands are the ones that we should follow if there's a conflict between the specific and the general obligation. But it turns out this solution doesn't work so well.
So you cannot just, I mean, an easy way out would have been to say, well, there is an overall general prohibition to perform any violence, which is general, and out of the principle of specificity, you will overrule this prohibition in the specific cases which are ruled by more specific commands.
So it'd be something, the solution that you might try that won't work is to say, well, the first kind of command is something like, well, ordinarily, here's what you should do. Ordinarily, in most circumstances, generally, you shouldn't kill living beings. But then there are some specific cases where it turns out that it's okay, and those specific cases are cases which kind of override that general kind of defeasible principle. Is that the basic idea?
That's a perfect summary of the problem, yes.
Although this approach doesn't work for resolving the problem, a thinker named Prabhakara, who lived sometime around the 7th century Common Era, had a different solution. He focused on who the command is supposed to be for and not on what it commands.
So I'll start with the thinker called Prabhakara. Prabhakara basically says that this first part of the command, the one saying, if you desire to kill your enemy, then you should do etc., etc., doesn't mean that the death of your enemy is the result of the sacrifice. It only picks up the addressee of the command. Similarly, in all other cases, say, the Chitra sacrifice or any other sacrifice, the first part of the command saying, if you desire sun, if you desire rain, if you desire cattle, if you desire village, this part of the command doesn't say that the sacrifice will give you rain, a sun, or a village. It only identifies the addressee of the command. So the rewriting of the command, according to Prabhakara, is suppose you are in the position to desire to kill your enemy, then you should do that. So basically, we have the addressee of the command is someone who is already in a situation they should not be in.
On this approach, when we reflect on our new obligations to distance ourselves in social and other situations during the spread of the coronavirus, Prabhakara might have us think then about who the command is for.
If you can work from home, the government says you should, and your employer should help you do this.
Not everyone is obligated to work inside. Only those people who have jobs and can work remotely, and so on. These obligations are relative to certain people, and even if we don't ideally want people to be going outside during a pandemic, Prabhakara's point, according to Elisa, is that the world is not ideal. So some commands are given to people in that non-ideal situation. If you're in the non-ideal position of having to leave your home, then you should keep distance between yourself and other people. Or, in the context of the Shena sacrifice,
they're already desiring to commit violence, which is already sort of like one step lower than where they should be. Because if you desire to commit violence, you'll probably commit violence and you'll be transgressing the prohibition to perform any violence. So basically, it's some sort of like, you should be in an ideal world in which you do not desire the death of your enemy, but should you be in this less ideal world in which you do desire to kill your enemy, then there is another obligation which is incumbent upon you.
But for Prabhakara, there are other commands which should be followed from the perspective of an ideal world, one known as the Agni Shoma sacrifice. Maybe we could think of being healthy analogous to this. In an ideal world, everyone would want to be healthy, and so they are going to fulfill the obligation to wash their hands.
By contrast, the case of the Agni Shomia is, according to Prabhakara, completely different, because in that case, the obligation is on the same level of ideality, in the same ideal world as any other Vedic obligation. So it addresses the ideal addressee, and therefore it overrules the general prohibition to perform violence because of specificity.
Prabhakara's views become important for a whole set of philosophers who follow him, and they become called Prabhakaras, with the first A, pronounced in a long way, Prabhakara. These philosophers tend to agree with much of what Prabhakara says, though not everything. They also find ways to criticize and revise what he argues, but they think of themselves as following in his footsteps. Other philosophers, though, have much more significant disagreements with Prabhakara, and they follow another thinker who lived about the same time as him in the 7th century Common Era. This philosopher was named Kumaralabhata, and the thinkers that follow him get called Bhattas, with also a long A instead of a short one. Elisa says that Kumarala has a different approach than Prabhakara does to this Shena sacrifice.
So Kumarala has a different understanding of the issue. He says that the point is that the prohibition to perform any violence is about violence as part of the coveted result of your action. So just like the prohibition to perform any violence doesn't mean that a doctor should not be, I don't know, opening your mouth to take out a rotten tooth or something like that, that doesn't count as violence. The only thing which is being prohibited by that command is violence as a result of your action, but not violence as an instrument. And in the case of the Agni Shomia, you are not really wanting to kill the sacrificial animal. You just happen to have to kill it because this is part of the ritual procedure. By contrast, in the case of the Shena, the death of your enemy is exactly the thing you want. So that's the kind of violence which is being prohibited. So the Shena should just not be performed because it's exactly within the precinct of application of the prohibition to perform any violence, whereas the Agni Shomia should be performed because in that case there is no prohibition which applies to that. It's just instrumental violence like the one performed by dentists.
Now, it's important to not misunderstand what Kumarala is saying here. He is saying that there is really violence in both the evil Shena sacrifice and the good Agni Shoma sacrifice. It's just that the violence occurs in different places. He's not saying that one of them is not really violence.
Yeah, okay, so you're spot on because that's the solution which other authors used. Namely, they said, well, in the case of the Shena sacrifices, it's not really the same kind of violence as in the case of the Agni Shomia. In the case of the Agni Shomia, there's no violence at all because the animal being killed, in fact, will be reborn in heaven, in Svarga. So that's no violence at all.
Yeah, right. So it seems like there's two ways to think about this, the analogy with the doctor. Some people might say with Kumarala, well, yeah, sure, surgery is violent. You have to cut open a chest, and that's genuine violence. But because the doctor's not aiming just to cut open your chest, they're aiming to heal you, that's okay. But a terrible murderer whose aim is to cut open your chest and to thereby harm you, that's not allowed. Somebody else, though, might say, well, actually, it's not really violence in the case of the doctor. There's cutting and there's pain, but that doesn't amount to violence. In the other case, there's actually violence. So it sounds like those are the sort of two different approaches that you're describing. Is that about right?
That's perfect. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much for taking some time to help us understand the Shena sacrifice and some of the solutions to it.
I know, it's always fun to talk about the Shena.
So we have a few different ways to understand our obligations. When, for instance, the government says you shouldn't go outside, but if you do go outside, you should stay 6 feet away from other people. For Prabhakara, people who have a desire to go outside are operating in less than ideal conditions, and they're obligated to go outside in a particular way, that is, staying 6 feet away from other people, despite the government's prohibition on leaving your home. For Kumarala, he would consider whether what you're aiming at is in contradiction with the clearly put prohibition. Is leaving your home just a means to get some important medical supplies? Or is it the thing you're aiming at? If it's the first, then there really isn't a contradiction, since leaving home is instrumental, a means to an end. If the second, there is a contradiction because, well, it's the thing you're trying to get, and you've been prohibited from trying to get that. Now, Prabhakara and Kumarala's views aren't the only ones in Mimamsa on this matter, but they do show two contrasting approaches to solving this puzzle, and they're influential for many years afterwards. And now, if you're stuck at home, thinking about whether you should or shouldn't leave your house, you have a bit more ways to think about this problem that can occupy your time. For some reading suggestions, as always, take a look at the show notes on Anchor or my website. All right, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.